Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today is Michelle Black. When Green Beret Brian Black was killed in an ambush in Niger 2017, Michelle was left alone with two young sons to raise. What followed Brian's death was an even more difficult journey for the young widow. After receiving few and contradictory details about the attack that took her husband's life, it was up to Michelle to find answers. "I'd prefer to hear an ugly truth than a beautiful lie," she says. "In the year following my husband's death, I was told plenty of both." She literally turned herself into an investigative journalist to tell this story. The book is called Sacrifice, A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth. It's part love story to her husband, Brian Black, and the investigative side of it is really fascinating. It makes you really think about the spin that we are told and the facts behind them. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Michelle Black is the mother of two boys and a Gold Star wife. She has a background in environmental sciences and horticulture. She's an experienced snowboarder and has a passion for writing. And that comes across in her book, too. She lives right here in Washington State. And again, her book is called Sacrifice, A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth. And here's my guest, Michelle Black. Michelle Black, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. I think your story is an important one to share. Your book, Sacrifice, is about the fight for truth surrounding the ambush of your husband's Green Beret team. And your determination to get to the bottom of what happened leading up to the ambush is a really compelling story. I want to begin by just getting to know you and Brian a little bit and sharing a little bit of your life with our listeners about what life was like before this horrible event. You met in Mammoth, one of my favorite places, Mammoth, a ski town. Tell us about that.
So after college, we both happened to go up there just to ski and have some fun. I was a snowboard instructor and a snowboarder. He was a skier, and he actually played online poker for a living. And we met at church one night. Before long, we were planning backpacking trips. And after about a year, he proposed. Hmm. So it was pretty quick.
It seems like such a switch going from playing online poker to joining the military, which he did. But obviously, there was a very strong connection there with you from the get-go. So you guys get married and you have children. At what point did he decide he wanted a military life?
Well, he'd always dreamed of becoming a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret, and once we had kids and poker just, the restrictions on it were kind of tightening up, and 2008 hit, and he was just having a hard time getting a job at that point between, you know, having only played poker and having that on his resume.
Right.
And with the financial troubles that kind of hit everybody in 2008, we thought, well, you know, the military might not be a bad way to go.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about Brian and what he was like as a man, what he was like as a husband, a friend, a father. I have to tell you, I've seen an interview with you and your face just lights up when you talk about him.
Yeah, he was wonderful. He just, you know, he was one of the kindest people I'd ever met, very selfless, but he was also one of the most intelligent people I'd ever met. He was a chess champion, won second at nationals when he was only 11 years old.
Wow.
He was, yeah, just like everybody who met him, that's one of the first things they'll tell you is he was incredibly intelligent, but he was also extremely humble. So he would always tell me, "You're never the smartest person in the room," because I'd tell him, "Oh, you're so smart," and he'd always say, "Yeah, but there's always somebody smarter than you." So he just was exceedingly kind, humble, but intelligent. He was also just so strong and capable. He, you know, had a background in mixed martial arts, had done some cage fighting, and when I met him, he looked like he should have, you know, been fresh out of a, you know, some sort of MMA fight.
Right.
But, you know, he just, everything about him was just so, it's almost indescribable, you know, just something out of a movie. He was really the epitome of a Green Beret.
Listening to you describe him there, it's maybe not so much a jump from online poker player, because that's just what he did. This sounds, the military side of his career sounds much more about what he was.
That's exactly right. The minute he got into the military, it's like he couldn't, you know, do enough. He loved it. Everything, I knew pretty early on, okay, he's going to end up doing the Special Forces thing. So it didn't surprise me when pretty quick after he joined, he wanted to go to SFAS, which is Special Forces Selection, because he just was always doing something new, wanting to learn something new. And even after he finished the Q course and graduated as a Green Beret, he pretty much went straight into Ranger School, was so excited to get his tab, spoke Arabic. He had learned that and during the Q course, and then he taught himself French in Hausa just so he could be more effective when he was deployed.
Right, right. And so how long had he been in the military? You moved around quite a bit, but you did anyway before then, right?
We did, yeah. We were fairly transient. I think we moved once a year, every year for the first 5 years of our marriage. So, and then once he joined the military, you know, we went from Washington State to Colorado and then to North Carolina. So, yeah.
And so how long had he been in the military before this last round?
He had been in total 7 years when he was killed. He was older when he joined.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I want to say, 28.
So when you were saying goodbye to him on his last deployment, you write that you had a feeling that you didn't want to let him go. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've always had strong premonitions when things are about to go badly. And, you know, it's hard to describe. All I know is that as he left, it was the first time he deployed or left home for, you know, training or anything when I couldn't let him go. I had to force myself. Mm-hmm. And then I was emotional after I left him, which didn't make sense. We were both pretty good at just, hey, have a good time. I'll see you in a couple months. No big thing. And this time was different.
Mm.
Just was.
Right, right. And so when you learned of the attack, had you had a similar kind of premonition? Or was it a total surprise to you when that happened?
I'd had a premonition. I had been, you know, concerned for days. And then that day, as I was walking across my room early in the morning, it just hit me. And it felt like, you know, I don't even know how to explain it. Something similar had happened to me when right before my dad died, and it was like the presence of God or just this spiritual being all around me telling me that everything was going to be okay, to just trust him, and I panicked. And then that night, his mom actually called me and said, hey, there's been an attack up near the Mali border on a Green Beret team, and I instantly knew. I told her that was Brian. Brian's team was there, and he was dead. And it was an hour later that I got a knock at the door.
I can't even imagine opening the door because, I mean, you open the door and see people out there, and you just, you know, well, there's no coming back from that, right?
Yeah. I actually sat on my front steps waiting to hear the car pull up, and then I peeked out my window when they pulled up. I was sure they were coming.
Yeah. So I can't imagine. I mean, this is a terrible loss for you and your two boys. They were, what, 9 and 11, I think, when this happened?
Yes, they were 9 and 11.
Right. And so you're told what? What does the military tell you to start with?
They have a whole thing they read off to you, but essentially they just tell you, you know, there was an incident overseas, your loved one has been killed in action. So it's a very formal thing they read off, but I can't tell you exactly what
right.
was in it anymore. I went instantly into shock.
Of course, yeah. And then, of course, you have to tell your boys, and it doesn't stop with you. It's his parents, and everybody is involved, and it's a terrible, terrible loss. And then on top of that, you know, so you're left a widow with two young boys. Your eldest child is autistic. You know, I can't even imagine how you process the next a few days there. And then all of a sudden the media starts this massive frenzy, as they tend to do when stories like this happen. And you start hearing stories reporting back that the team, the Green Beret team, was to blame for this event. Tell us how that felt.
It was fairly overwhelming, obviously. You know, you want to just grieve, and then everywhere you go, you know, I always say you never realize how many TVs are out in public areas until your husband's face is splashed all over it. So everywhere we went, I would see Brian, Dustin, Jeremiah, and LaDavid lined up on every TV screen with just different news of what happened. And a lot of the news were things like, you know, this team, they were a bunch of cowboys, they went rogue. That began to be reported pretty early on, and I knew my husband. I knew he wouldn't go rogue, and I knew he wasn't a cowboy. It just didn't fit his personality, and while I didn't know all the other guys, I knew quite a few of them, and I knew Green Berets. It just didn't fit who they are, not after that much training. And so that didn't make sense, and there were other things they were saying, like when the bullets flew, the team fell apart, which also made no sense.
Mm. Yeah, and they weren't even there for a mission. They were there to assist and advise, weren't they? Which makes this story even more horrifying, really, because they were there to help and not to do a mission.
Precisely. They were there in a buy with and through capacity, which is just an advise and assist. They're training the local Nigerian unit so that they can protect their own borders against the rise of, militant extremism. So that's what they were there for. And basically, when those at higher headquarters begin to get, you know, signals intelligence that there might be a terrorist nearby, they began to send the team out kind of in a sense to look for him. In fact, they attached a reconnaissance vehicle to the team, which had, you know, equipment inside of it to look for all of these things,
mm-hmm.
try and look for signals intelligence. And that's not what that team was in country to do.
Right. And so knowing this and hearing the stories that are going around, not reporting the truth of, as it has been investigated, but really reporting what they've been told, that, I imagine, must have added tremendous fuel to your already burning fire.
It did. I think as you're going through grief, what you want is you don't want all this information. What you want is just the truth. That's it, pure and simple truth. And so to have so many different talking points, to have my husband's death, first of all, be a talking point, and then to have so many different versions of the truth coming at me, I didn't know what to believe, you know? And, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, the media was so out of line, but they're reporting what they're hearing through people leaking from the investigation. So that's where my frustration came from, was why are people within the investigation that the military is doing, why are they leaking to the media?
Mm-hmm.
Because the media doesn't know what to do with this information other than report it, but they might not necessarily be someone who understands Green Berets and how they work, you know, so they're just reporting what they're hearing. And who's leaking this? Is this one of the officers who's actually at fault for what happened?
Right. Right, because they were doing their own internal investigation, right? Instead of separating themselves and having somebody else investigate it.
Correct, exactly. And I get it in my book. I get into that a little bit about how initially it was SOC Africa who had started an investigation. And then AFRICOM essentially shut that down because...
And AFRICOM stands for what?
Africa Command. It's a four-star command over all of the continent of Africa. And SOC Africa is a three-star command. So the four-star command could come over SOC Africa and order their investigation shut down and begin to investigate instead.
Mm.
So they had that authority. And so AFRICOM began to essentially investigate AFRICOM.
Yeah. So you start asking questions because you're left, obviously, with far more questions than answers. At what point did you decide to go... to start writing a book on this? And the book, again, is called Sacrifice, A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth. What point did you decide to write a book?
Well, as you said, a lot of these things begin to build up. And for me, I think it was at the end of all of it. So Brian died. We were told all of these things through the media that I knew weren't true. And then they released a headcam video showing my husband's death that leaked all across, you know, YouTube, Twitter. And by then, my anxiety and stress was through the roof. And I thought, surely we're going to be briefed and we're going to hear the truth. And instead, we went into our brief. It was 7 months later. I felt absolutely terrorized between watching my husband die, having my own countrymen watch him die. And I thought, okay, we're going to hear the truth at least from the military. And the military then tells me a bunch of half-truths and outright lies during the brief, which I detail in the book. And at that point, I didn't know what to do. I was taking a minute to kind of sift through it all when General Waldhauser went in the press and said, you know, all teams on the continent are performing well, but this team is not indicative of what they do.
Hmm.
So when he completely lambasted the team and my husband and all those who fought and died alongside him, that's when I realized there will be no justice, not just for me, but for any of the family members, for those who died and those who survived the ambush. Everyone's going to be punished. And that's when I'd had enough and I decided to do this.
Yes, because in addition to four from the Green Beret team, five Nigerians were killed too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and to brush that under the rug when some very obvious mistakes were made at a leadership level. I justice is one thing. Exposure is your next best thing, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, I began to realize that not only were they just saying that they weren't just saying, hey, the team is at fault, but they were going one step further and saying, now we're going to punish them and we're going to blame those who died as well for being inept.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stand for that.
Yeah. So you start researching, you start talking with members of the team and other people who survived. Were they reluctant to talk with you at first? I know there was a gag order at one point, but when that was lifted, were they reluctant to talk to you, or were they, you know, did they want to get this story out too?
They, honestly, they did this for me as a favor because they, at that point, just wanted it to end. And I think even now they feel that way. They just want this to be over, and it seems to never be over. And what they wanted was not to be punished and just to get on and get back to their jobs. They love their jobs. They love their lives. And so initially it was, first of all, we'd rather not talk, but also we don't want to drag you into this. And I told them, I said, well, you're not dragging me into anything. The day Brian died, I became involved. And at this point, what are you worried about? And they were worried about it, something coming back on me.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going to happen? Are they going to kill my husband? You know, put his death on TV, lie to me? At this point, I had nothing left to lose.
Mm.
And that's when they said, you know, you're right, and we'd like to do this for you. And so from there, they trusted me with that story. And I told them at any point, if they wanted me to share that with anybody or get rid of the story, I would. But for now, I was going to hold on to it for them and carry it through to a book. And,
And you did. So congratulations on that, because it's not easy to write a book, especially one on such, which obviously has put you through a wide range of emotions as you're going through this, researching it, writing, editing. I can't imagine what kind of roller coaster you must have been on.
It was pretty incredible. You know, initially I thought, oh, I'm going to write the story of just what happened on the ground. I didn't think I would find as much as I did. I started in May of 2018, right after the media brief, and I interviewed all of the surviving team members. But then I went on and I interviewed Alan Van Son, Major Alan Van Son, General Don Bolduc, who was the former SOC Africa commander. I also interviewed people who were back at the Advanced Operations Base communicating with guys on the ground. And I interviewed the former Team Arleigh commander, who was involved throughout the situation. His Helleborn unit was supposed to fly in that day and got turned around due to weather. And, you know, I also spoke to guys who were involved on the level of they went out to Tongo Tongo with the investigative team and saw the aftermath of on the ground and bullet holes in trees and all of that, as well as guys who had helped to write up some of the awards and seen who caused all the downgrades, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah. The mission itself wasn't supposed to happen, as we discussed earlier. They were supposed to be there just to train. But when they get sent on this mission, I mean, you write about this in the book, and it just seems like one mistake after another, one horrendous day after another. But there's a point that, gosh, it almost brought me to tears here, where the captain is, tell me how you say his name, is it Perazzini?
It is, Perazzini.
So Captain Perazzini wants to abort the mission. And the message in there, he says it makes no sense. We've had no sleep. We're low on water. We don't know where we're going. Don't know anything about where we're going. We don't have the proper assets. Request to abort. And that was denied by somebody presumably sitting behind a desk somewhere.
That's exactly correct. There were multiple times when he pushed back and said, we absolutely should not be on this mission. In fact, one huge thing that gets missed is that the Helleborn unit that was coming in, it's often reported and even stated in the report that Team Arleigh was brought in, the Helleborn unit was brought in, this was their mission, and that this was all a big idea of Lieutenant Colonel Painter. But when talking to the team, I found out that the commander of Team Arleigh was a friend of Captain Perazzini's, and Captain Perazzini was being told that they needed to go up to the border alone, and he's the one who said, we need to bring in a Helleborn unit to make this operation safe and feasible, because we have no air assets, and I am not agreeing to do this mission without any air assets. And so it was Captain Perazzini who came up with that plan. And then once all of those higher up the chain became kind of came on board with that plan, then my husband's team was sent ahead while the mission planning with the Helleborn unit happened between Lieutenant Colonel Painter, Colonel Moses, and those all the way up the chain of command. And so then they got up to the border, they were waiting, and that's when they heard in the middle of the night that Team Arleigh got turned around, and that's when Mike just went, this is not safe, we should not be out here, we request to abort the mission and come home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they were told, no, you need to stay out there.
Yeah, and based on what? I mean, how did it make you feel when you learned that?
I was pretty upset because, you know, over and over we heard that the first mission the guys went on, which was just, you know, up to this little town, Tillowa, and back, that the report and the mission plan that Captain Perazzini had put together for that was what was responsible for the team being attacked in the end, because they were a bunch of cowboys who had gone rogue and wanted to chase after a terrorist. And so seeing that not only was that not true, but that it was the two follow-on missions that were created by those highest up the chain of command that directly led to my husband's team being ambushed and my husband's death, it was absolutely heart-wrenching. And, you know, at any point, if they had listened to Mike Perazzini, my husband and his team would have been back in Wallam in their, at their base at sleep, you know, in their beds at sleep, not out being attacked.
Yeah, and then to not have the not to have the courage to stand up and admit a mistake, and they try and bury it and blame the team itself, it is absolutely reprehensible. Surprisingly, you say you do not have any resentment toward the military. It's the individuals involved. You still love the military. You'd like your sons to be involved in the military. Tell us about that.
You know, the military as a whole is incredible. I grew up about as far from the military as a person could. And until I met Brian's dad, who's a Marine, I honestly didn't know anyone who had served. So, you know, it's strange that my feelings have changed so much, and not in a bad way. I love the military, what it stands for, the community of special operators that, you know, my husband and I were a part of, and I love the ideals of serving, sacrifice, honor, and respect for everyone that you can find throughout our military community. So these ideals really are what make America such a great nation. So my dislike isn't for the military. It really is just for injustice, and that's what this book was born out of, really the injustice of a few individuals.
Yeah. You have a redacted investigative report on your website for people if they want to look at this. I'm wondering what kind of feedback you've had now the book's been out a little while.
You know, the feedback's been excellent. If you go on Amazon and you go to you look at my book, Sacrifice of Gold Star Widows for Fight for the Truth, you'll find that I've got almost all 5 stars. People are loving the book. It's very thorough and extremely detailed account on the ground, because the men only spoke to me, so I'm the only one who knows precisely what happened on the ground those 3 days. And so I've been getting really good reviews, especially from the military community. So I encourage people to really go and check it out, especially if you're into a good military story. And, yeah, the redacted report is on my website. It's the only place online that you'll find it anymore. It's been completely removed by the military from all public, you know, access areas, so you can't access it. So I kept the PDF and put it up on my author site, which is michelleblacksacrifice.com.
Great. And you say that, you know, people often, I've heard it and I've said it myself, people say, oh, thank you for your sacrifice to military families. I don't think we have any clue about what that sacrifice is like. And you write that, of course, it doesn't stop. That sacrifice doesn't stop with the death of a spouse. What do you want to tell us about that?
You know, it's amazing, especially coming to the end of 20 years in Afghanistan. And one huge thing that I don't think we've even fully realized as a country is that that means we have a generation of broken homes from this war, whether they've been broken by PTSD or they've been broken by the loss of a parent. And so a ton of, you know, I know my house, you know, now we've got a single family home. My kids will be raised without a father. That'll affect them. That'll affect my grandkids, my great grandkids. So that's a generation completely, you know, affected by war. And I think we're only beginning to see the fallout from that. And so we really need to work hard to support our veterans and their families and those who are left behind without, you know, the Gold Star families who are left without a spouse.
Right. Right. And you write that you'd rather hear an ugly truth than a beautiful lie. And in the year following Brian's death, you were told plenty of both. What do you hope that the military leadership will take away from this story?
I hope they'll really take to heart that, you know, a life matters more than, you know, in the truth. A life and the truth really matters more than a career. Your career will end and no one will care whether or not you had 1 star or 2 stars. And, you know, but you'll have to live with yourself for the rest of your life for what you did to these men and women's families.
Hmm. Michelle Black, such a pleasure talking with you. And I know how hard it must be to share this story over and over. So I certainly appreciate it. The book is called Sacrifice, A Gold Star Widow's Fight for the Truth. Listeners can find out much more about you and the book and the redacted report at michelleblacksacrifice.com. What would you like us to know that we haven't talked about? What would you like to leave us with about Brian?
That, you know what, he would have gladly sacrificed his life for everybody's freedom. And I think that people need to realize that. As they read this, I hope they understand more clearly what freedom has cost those who have paid the ultimate price, but more importantly, that we wouldn't change it. Nothing worth having comes without a steep price. So I hope that my readers will walk away appreciating their freedoms more and hold more love and pride in the men and women who serve our nation.
Michelle Black, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.